From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Is it geoengineering or hacking the climate? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point. A raging dispute among climate scientists is breaking into the open. Could they slow global warming by injecting aerosols into the atmosphere to reflect sunlight? Or are the unintended consequences potentially so dangerous that even experimentation should be prohibited? The very idea was beyond the pale at the time of the Paris Agreement, but now it's gaining some traction. Opponents say it's beyond reckless. Would trying to resolve one problem create others that could get out of control? That's our main topic today. On our talking point later, Attorney General Jeff Sessions escalates the war on drugs. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Check out kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. The Paris agreements won't be enough to reverse global warming, whether President Trump pulls the U.S. out or not. Is it time to try altering the atmosphere by what's called geoengineering? We'll hear about unintended consequences, international relations, and ethics. Today's talking point, the Obama administration lightened up on the war on drugs. Today, Attorney General Jeff Sessions said federal prosecutors are now unhandcuffed, and he ordered them to be as tough as possible. First, this news update. President Trump tweeted a warning this morning to the former FBI director that he fired. James Comey better hope there are no tapes of our conversations before he starts leaking to the press, says the president. Jeff Mason of Reuters asked about that when White House spokesman Sean Spicer started his briefing today.
Why did he say that? Why did he tweet that? What should we interpret from that?
As I mentioned, the president has nothing further to add on that.
Are there recording devices in the Oval Office or in the residence?
As I said for the third time, there is nothing further to add on that.
Does he think it's appropriate to threaten someone like Mr. Comey not to speak?
I don't think that's not a threat. He's simply stated a fact. The tweet speaks for itself. I'm moving on.
Edward Isaac DeVere is chief Washington correspondent for Politico. Great to have you with us.
Hi, Warren.
Mr. Spicer began by talking about the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, and previous to that, General McMaster's, the National Security Advisor, came out and talked about a trip the president's not taking for a week. Is there a kind of strategy of distraction here?
It certainly seems like that. We also had yesterday, when there were many questions at the briefing, an appearance by Tom Bossert, who's a White House aide, talking about a cybersecurity executive order, which the White House had been talking about for some time but not really moving on, and all of a sudden the president signed yesterday. It's also what happened with his voter fraud, election fraud commission, which he had talked about and then forgotten about and all of a sudden threw up yesterday as something that he was talking about. It does seem like this is a White House that wants to do what it can to talk about things other than the Jim Comey firing, which is what it seems like everybody else would like to talk to them about.
And one of the problems is contradictions that continue between the staff and the president himself. Here is what White House spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders said yesterday about Comey's firing.
This absolutely has nothing to do with any investigation into Russia.
And just hours later, the president said this to NBC's Lester Holt.
When I decided to just do it, I said to myself, I said, you know, this Russia thing with Trump and Russia is a made-up story. It's an excuse by the Democrats for having lost an election.
So, Edward Isaac DeVere, the contradiction is obvious. How does the White House explain it?
They don't, really. They say that we're all getting it wrong, but it's just there's no way to look at the things that the president has said, the things that were in the letter that he wrote to Comey firing Comey on on Tuesday. The things that the White House press aides have said at different points over the course of these couple of days, and say that they all match up. So we have a White House that is running into a problem of multiple statements that not all of them can be true.
The president tweeted, as a very active president with lots of things happening, it's not possible for my surrogates to stand at the podium with perfect accuracy. Is he, despite what we hear in that tweet, angry at his staff?
He's angry at his press coverage, and he blames it on his staff. That's not unusual for a president. I've covered Barack Obama for a number of years, and he used to complain that the message just wasn't getting out about what they were doing. But this is a different thing that's going on here with Donald Trump, where he is changing the story himself all the time and not informing his aides about what's going on. They were taken by surprise by the firing of Comey. There was no time to build a strategy of what to do. I was talking to a guy who was a spokesperson for John Ashcroft when he was Attorney General yesterday, who said to me, they're like hostages in the White House Communications Office. They just are bound to whatever the president is doing, and the president himself doesn't seem to think that there's any need to start looping the people who have to answer for him into the process, and then gets mad at those people for not doing a good enough job explaining it.
Another presidential tweet. Maybe the best thing to do would be to cancel all future press briefings and hand out written responses for the sake of accuracy. Does he mean that?
We'll see. This is not the first time they've threatened to change the process at the White House. There was talk about closing the briefing room down at the beginning of the administration, actually, even during the transition. But, you know, they are facing questions right now, today, yesterday, about things that the president has said and done that they seem to not be able to answer. The question that you cited about whether the president really meant that there were recording devices in the White House is one that is a real question. We don't, and one that has implications. And the White House refusing to answer that does not mean that's the end of the story. What the assumption will be now from anybody, especially foreign leaders who think about the Oval Office as a place where they can meet in confidence with the leader of the country and the leader of the free world, will assume that now there is a recording device in the Oval Office. And that is, every time the president says these things, it leads to consequences like that. The different versions that he's offered about what happened with the Comey firing, whether the Russia investigation was what prompted him to do it or wasn't, is something that now can be dredged up by congressional committees if they want to, via subpoena and having people under oath. And those sorts of things can become problems for an administration now.
Okay, Edward Isaac DeVere, again, Chief Washington Correspondent for Politico. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you.
In a moment, is it geoengineering or hacking the climate? To the Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're on Alney back with To the Point. In Alaska today, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson acknowledged the risks of global warming to Arctic nations. It's still not clear if the president will pull the U.S. out of the Paris agreements. In the meantime, an idea that was once beyond the pale is now out in the open. It's geoengineering, which means releasing aerosols into the atmosphere to reflect sunlight and cool the planet. David Keith is a Harvard professor of applied physics and public policy. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
That's very much a layman's description of geoengineering. Maybe you can make it a little clearer than I did.
Oh, I can give it a shot. The idea, which has really been around in some form for 40 years or so, is that when humans might be able to deliberately make the planet a little more reflective, say by putting aerosols, which are very fine particles, like a fine droplet in a cloud or a droplet of dust, into the upper atmosphere where they stay for a couple years, and to put those aerosols in so they reflect away a tiny bit of sunlight, that would reduce the kind of net energy imbalance of the Earth, if you like, that's created by the buildup of carbon dioxide, the thing that's causing climate change. And that would temporarily and quite imperfectly reduce the amount of climate change that happens, and so reduce some of the risks of climate change for a given amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And I guess the to me, the bottom line is, at best, this is a supplement to cutting emissions. We have to cut emissions of carbon dioxide to zero eventually if we want a stable climate. But it may be a very powerful supplement that really reduces risks a lot, risks especially to some of the world's poorest and to ecosystems. But it comes with a lot of risk and uncertainty itself. So the big question now is how much research we do, I think.
By research, do you mean experimentation, actually trying it?
Not trying to do it at scale. I don't think that makes any sense. There's a whole set of small sort of geophysical experiments that are, I think, do make sense. We're working on one of them ourselves. So that ranges from laboratory experiments to small field experiments. But these are not field experiments that aim to change the climate. They'd be tiny in that regard. But they'd be trying to understand some of the key physics and chemistry of the way the climate works that helps inform our models of how these techniques might work at large scale.
Tell us a little bit more about the experimentation that you are planning on conducting. What would it look like?
Well, so the first thing we're doing is laboratory experiments. And so we're this is all in regard to the possibility of putting aerosols in the stratosphere, which is one, but only one of the ideas for solar geoengineering. And we're particularly interested in understanding the environmental consequences of doing that. So one of the big concerns for decades has been that putting some aerosols in the stratosphere, sulfate aerosols in particular, can accelerate ozone loss. That ozone loss is ultimately caused by the chlorine compounds that humans put there through fluorocarbon emissions. And so we're interested in finding ways to understand and predict that more accurately, and also to find ways to reduce the ozone loss or even reverse it, so we actually help restore the ozone layer. So the experiments are experiments on the kinds of particles that might go in the stratosphere, like on calcium carbonate, kind of something like powdered limestone, or on sulfuric acid, the different sorts of particles people have talked about putting in the stratosphere. We're doing experiments in the laboratory to look at chemical reactions. And then we're, you know, slowly moving towards a field experiment that builds on previous field experiments we've done that would do small experiments from a balloon.
From a balloon. So it wouldn't be in the stratosphere, or would it be?
Oh, yeah, it would be in the stratosphere.
Okay.
The group that I'm part of has had a long history of doing stratospheric science that helped to untangle the cause of the ozone hole. And so we've built stratospheric instruments in the group for decades. And so this would be, in some sense, similar to that, but we'd be doing a manipulative experiment and that we'd be releasing a small amount of some aerosol, say calcium carbonate. But and then measuring over a day what it does to the local chemistry of the stratosphere.
All right, David Keith at Harvard. Again, you've said this was temporary and imperfect, a supplement to cutting global warming gases that we are now emitting. Raymond Pierre Humbert is with us. He's a professor of physics at Oxford, at the University of Oxford. It's good to have you on our program.
Hello, it's nice to be here, yes.
You have said that this is not just tricky, but wildly, utterly, howlingly, barking mad. What do you mean?
Well, yeah, so I'd say, you know, I think David and I are more or less in agreement that this is a terrifying thing to do. It's the question of at what point, if ever, does it make sense to do research on it and develop the technologies. But the essential problem with geoengineering, the reason I think that that this is really would be very premature even to do the kinds of experiments David is talking about right now, is the problem of time scales. That is, carbon dioxide that we emit today continues to affect the climate for thousands, even tens of thousands of years. And so if we don't actually succeed in getting our emissions all the way down to zero, then the geoengineering, the solar geoengineering, or I would prefer to call it albedo modification, because we don't know enough about the system to really say that we're engineering it. But whatever you call it, if we don't get our emissions down to zero, that means that the amount of warming grows year after year after year. And so whatever you do to try to cancel out some of that with shooting something into the stratosphere, you have to do more of it each year. And so unless you can demonstrate that we actually have the ability to bring our emissions down to zero, this is a useless technology. It's not even a stopgap. And there's the danger that if you do it to a certain extent, that you manage to succeed in reducing a certain amount of the warming, people will just forget that there's a problem altogether and just emit more and more carbon dioxide, leading to this sort of death spiral where you're emitting more carbon dioxide, doing more geoengineering, until the point where a war or something happens, you suddenly have to stop your geoengineering. Then you have all that accumulated warming that will hit you in just 10 or 15 years. And so I can imagine a sort of very well-regulated world where everybody is in agreement and we just do a little bit of this and we are going to get our emissions down to zero. But in a world where Donald Trump is president, that's not the world we live in. And so I think this is a very dangerous technology to unleash at this point, even at a small scale.
Back to David Keith, it sounds like maybe you're not in agreement, even though Professor Humbert says you might be.
No, I actually think there's a lot of agreement there. But remember, we're scientists. We don't make the political decisions. So it's absolutely true, as Ray said, that in the long run, if you don't bring emissions to zero, the underlying climate problem just keeps getting worse. No argument whatsoever. Both Ray and I spent lots of our lives trying to argue that people should cut emissions. And it's important to say that despite the lunacy of Donald Trump, there's progress. The last 3 years, there's been no increase in emissions. And there's been enormous progress on solar power getting cheaper. And I think there is reason to believe we'll eventually bring emissions down. But my view is that this technology may reduce the risks, however quickly we bring emissions down, and that a technology that could profoundly reduce risks, and that's what it shows from the whole suite of climate models we have, and there's basic reasons of basic physics to believe it as well, could substantially reduce risks, especially risks for the poorest among us, people who are most vulnerable to climate change, say risks from extreme events like tropical cyclones, that it makes sense to investigate it seriously, to understand what its risks are and how well it could work, and to bring it out in the open. Basically, I believe that sunlight is a good disinfectant of these ideas, and we need them in the open so people can freely see them and debate them.
Professor,
one of the things that Ray said implicitly was the assumption that if we keep emitting CO2, then we have to keep increasing this. That's an assumption about how it gets used. It's not a scientific statement. It's an implicit assumption that the goal is going to be to keep temperatures constant. But it's a political decision what the goal is. And it would certainly be meaningful to do solar geoengineering temporarily as a way to reduce the rate of change. And the overwhelming evidence from the climate impacts community, people who study the impacts of climate on natural systems and human systems, is the rate of change is a big driver of risk.
David Keith, once again at Harvard. We'll come back to him and to Professor Humbert at Oxford as well. But first, here is the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, former CEO of ExxonMobil, of course. Here's what he said to the Council on Foreign Relations in 2012.
It's an engineering problem, and it has engineering solutions. And so the fear factor that people want to throw out there to say, we just have to stop this, I do not accept.
Simon Nicholson is co-founder of the Forum for Climate Engineering Assessment. Good to have you on our show.
Yeah, thanks for it.
Mr. Tillerson said it's an engineering problem. Does that suggest that if, in fact, the geoengineering that we've talked about, or solar engineering, as Professor Humbert calls it, were, in fact, implemented, that there would be a tendency to say, wait a minute, this is an engineering problem, we're dealing with it, we don't have to cut back on emissions after all?
Yeah, so far from your other guests, the conversation has been mainly about the physical and environmental implications of moving in this direction. What's been hinted at is that there are lots of very profoundly troubling political questions in this space. And one of the most profound political questions is what this means for the rest of the climate response agenda. We could imagine that if this gets dangled out in front of the international community as some kind of solution, as a kind of a plan B, as some have talked about it, then it might really distract from the need to, as both of your guests have already suggested, cut emissions to zero. And that would be the worst outcome of trying to treat climate change as an engineering problem. It's much, much bigger and more challenging than that.
Elaborate, if you will, on what some of the other kinds of consequences might be, particularly the political ones.
Yeah, so there are a lot of potential political challenges attached to even investigation in this space. The one that I just mentioned is often called the moral hazard, and that is it might distract from the need to cut emissions. But others talk about the potential danger, for instance, of discovering down the road after a research program is underway that it's a bad idea, but we're already locked into a pathway that takes us to deployment. And this is either a slippery slope argument or some call it a technological lock-in argument. Now, these sorts of problems are surmountable. We can imagine developing forms of governance, forms of institutions and so forth around even research that might limit the potential negative implications of moving in this direction. But some have gone so far as to say that climate engineering is actually ungovernable, and that's something that Ray was starting to hint at in his comments.
Ungovernable. What do you mean by that?
Well, yeah, so to get back to Ray's point, if we imagine that this will have to be something that's deployed, a sulfate shield in the stratosphere, to use a common example, if it has to be deployed not just for decades but potentially for millennia, it's hard to think of other instances where the human species has been able to sustain something cooperatively across that time span. And another challenge in this space, the normal way to think about climate change, if we're going to respond to it, is to have the entire global community come together around aggressive emissions reductions targets. It requires action from basically everybody on the planet. It's a big cooperative, coordinated action problem. The challenge with something like solar geoengineering is that one country could potentially go it alone. So the United States has the industrial capacity, so does China, Russia, many other countries, to launch a research program and potentially deployment of a sulfate shield. And that sets up a whole set of interesting kind of international political questions at a moment, as has been hinted, when it's not clear that the international community is able to rationally have these sorts of conversations.
Simon Nicholson at the Climate Engineering Assessment Forum. Ray Humbert, back to you at the University of Oxford. Talking with our producer today, you said that in some ways this reminds you of the development of the atomic bomb.
Well, yes. I mean, people go back and forth about how apt the analogy is and how far along that spectrum we are. But I was thinking particularly of the hydrogen bomb, because the question about whether the hydrogen bomb should ever have been developed by the U.S. is a lot more fuzzy than the question of the first atomic bomb.
Because we knew what the consequences might be. Is what you're saying?
Yes. This is just a way of saying that. That there are some kinds of research that are really not innocuous. Once you unleash a technology, it's almost inevitably going to be deployed. And we do decide that some technologies are just essentially not governable or too dangerous to ever be put into practice. So we try not to do research on biological weapons. We do very little on chemical weapons. I think the knowledge about how to make sarin gas is something that a lot of people would wish that we never had.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're running short of time for this break. We're going to go to a break, and we'll come back to all of you after that. But David Keith at Harvard, I'd like you to respond, if you will, briefly to what we have just heard from both our other guests.
Well, so both are implicitly assuming it has to be done for millennia. And if that's the assumption, then I completely agree it makes no sense to do it, and it's stupid. But that's an assumption that has no foundation. There's no reason to do that. It's a public policy choice. And if you actually think about the risks to people from climate change over this next century, reducing the rate of change could have profound benefits. And that's true even if you only do it for one century. So the claim that you have to do it forever is a claim that is rhetorically effective, because, of course, if it's true, then, yeah, we can't guarantee doing it forever. That'd be crazy. But it's a claim that's not based on a kind of coherent thinking through of the way climate policy will evolve.
What about the idea that if it were offered as a solution, we wouldn't, in fact, then try to reduce emissions to zero?
Well, that's been the largest concern. I think I was one of the first to raise that concern and to call it moral hazard. But it's by no means a done deal. And, in fact, it can go both ways. So I think the answer is yes, Exxon will certainly use it, or other oil companies, as a way to try and argue against emissions cuts. I think that already has happened a little bit and likely will happen some more. But the battle about emissions cuts is a major political battle that's been going on for decades.
All right. Back in a moment with this conversation. We'll continue it on our talking point later. Attorney General Jeff Sessions is escalating the war on drugs. This is To the Point from PRI.
Subscribe to the To The Point podcast at kcrw.com or download the KCRW app. available anywhere podcasts are found and on all mobile devices.
Norman Olney back with To The Point, once again talking about geoengineering, also called solar engineering, the idea that we could inject into the atmosphere materials that would reflect sunlight away and thus cool the atmosphere. And we've heard that there is a lot of dispute among scientists about whether it's a good idea. Jack Stilgo is a senior lecturer in the Department of Science and Technology Studies at the University of College London. He is the author of Experiment Earth, Responsible Innovation in Geoengineering. Welcome to you.
Hello, good afternoon.
What are some of the ethical issues involved in this?
I think we've already touched upon them. I mean, Simon Nicholson certainly mentioned the sort of the geopolitical dimensions of all of this. I think there's a sort of a fairly fundamental ethical question, though, about whether we are, as a species, ready to take responsibility for an aspect of our lives that has, until very recently, you know, we've referred to the weather and the climate as acts of God, right? This is one of those areas that human beings have claimed that they don't have any control over. And as soon as the human race starts down that road, I think that raises some gigantic ethical questions, and we don't yet have the capacity to take those on.
Well, haven't we already gotten in the way of what might be acts of God by emitting into the atmosphere so much stuff that the planet is warming?
So indeed, and this is sometimes a justification for geoengineering research, if not geoengineering the deployment of technologies, is that, in effect, we've already done this rather disastrous experiment of climate change, so therefore organizing that experiment a bit better wouldn't be such a gigantic ethical leap. I don't buy that argument because I think we need to take intention seriously. And I think as soon as we intentionally start controlling things, then that changes the nature of the game. But if we take the viewpoint of global ethics doesn't say anything about, well, who is it that's making these decisions, right? The question is not whether we as the human race all get together and make sensible decisions together, because that has never happened in the past, right? This would be some particular groups of people who would have enormous technological power concentrated in their hands, making decisions about the fate of the planet. Unprecedented, one could argue.
Would they likely to be middle-aged white guys, such as all of us that are talking on this conversation?
Well, quite. And I think, you know, we need to realize quite what a small world we represent in having this conversation. We need to realize how little we know about what the world's most vulnerable people would think about this as an option for dealing with climate change. So, you know, if we're talking about research questions, I think we need to be looking at research, finding out what those people that we think are going to benefit from geoengineering, right? David Keith was suggesting that this may help the most vulnerable people in the world. What might they actually think? Those people that have been largely alienated from the last 50 years of technological progress, would they think that this new concentration of power were a good thing? Now, I don't know. As a social scientist, I want to ask that question, but my suspicions are that there would be a huge amount of skepticism.
David Keith, let me go back to you again, a public policy and physics professor at Harvard University and a researcher into solar geoengineering. Go ahead.
Yeah, two comments. One is, I absolutely agree with Jack Stilgo about intention, so I don't buy the argument that because we're already messing it up by putting CO2 in, that it's okay to mess it up some more. I agree with him. I absolutely agree that we need to really engage and try and understand what the people in the most vulnerable places actually think, and we're doing that. So we've had active research efforts, say, in the Philippines and in India, who are going out and asking people what they think and engaging with people in governments there, and indeed other countries as well. The answers are pretty surprising and diverse, so I don't think they necessarily go along with Jack's supposition. And I think there's a second part of Jack's supposition, which is that this concentrates power. But I think that's not obvious at all. Think about the way technologies like the internet, other technologies that are cheap to reproduce once you have the idea, have actually in some ways made power both more concentrated in some hands, but also more diffuse around the world. That sounded too abstract. The point is, these technologies are pretty cheap, and there's no particular intellectual property controls. They're pretty easy to copy. So far, this conversation has been sort of somehow assuming that Donald Trump and the White House matter, or this is a thing the U.S. does. My guess is it's not what the U.S. does. My guess is if it happens, it's motivated more by countries that are suffering effects of climate change more strongly, countries like India or Philippines, Indonesia, wherever. And those are countries that easily can do it, because once the ideas are out there, once the science is done, there isn't any control over who does it. So I think it's not necessarily true that this concentrates power. If anything, it may diffuse power.
Raymond Pierre Humbert, back to you, a professor of physics at the University of Oxford. You're opposed to even doing research and experimentation, as I understand it. Would this, like global warming, have effects of causing, you know, flooding in one area, desertification in another area? Would it be possible to predict the kinds of things that might happen around the world as a result of fooling with the atmosphere?
Well, I that's a very interesting question, but I'm afraid I'm going to set that aside because it's important to respond to a rather absurd thing David said a bit earlier, that we don't have to do this geoengineering forever because you could always decide to stop. That's technically true, but it's like saying that if you get yourself into a state where you're a diabetic because of bad life choices, you don't have to take insulin forever. You could always stop. Of course, the consequences are that you die. And so I think that the range of circumstances in which you have an exit strategy for stopping the albedo modification, the solar engineering, are very narrow. They involve things like whether you have developed technologies for taking CO2 out of the atmosphere rapidly enough. There are ideas to do that, but we don't know whether they can really scale or whether there's the political will to actually deploy them. And so I just don't buy the argument that we can always choose to stop if we don't like it. You can get yourself into a state where it's essentially an addiction, and if you stop, you cause major crises.
Well, before we get then to my question, let's go back to David Keith and get you respond to what we just heard with regard to whether or not you could stop and or this would become a comparable to something like an addiction.
I think there's certainly a danger of the addiction, but let's really play the moral of this out. I feel like the argument that Ray is making at its core is that he doesn't trust people with this technology. The kiddies won't use it right. We're going to have a technology that might potentially reduce risk, but people will, instead of having their risk reduced, just have worse behavior. So let's play the analogy out. Does that mean that Ray would, say, oppose anti-AIDS drugs or other drugs for sexually transmitted diseases because the result might be that people engage in more risky behavior? Well, the answer is they do sometimes, but that's not a morally sound reason to oppose things that actually can reduce risks.
Okay. Professor Humbert, I have to give you an opportunity to respond. Go ahead.
Yes. I mean, the essential question there is whether this is a technology that actually is even potentially useful in reducing risks. And I would say that if we actually can demonstrate that the world has the maturity to even begin taking the steps needed to bring the CO2 emissions down to zero, and if we can agree to do that sort of thing, then we have the maturity as a global political or entity to actually perhaps make geoengineering governable. But until you actually make the case, until there's a pathway that not just stabilizes the CO2 emissions, but actually has them starting down to zero, we don't know whether the geoengineering, whether albedo modification, solar geoengineering, is even in a position to reduce the risks.
You used that phrase twice. What does albedo mean? Albedo modification.
Albedo means just the reflectivity of the Earth. In the National Academy report, we preferred the more neutral term, okay. Albedo modification, modifying the reflectivity of the Earth, the amount of sunlight reflected back to space, because it doesn't have the same connotations as engineering.
Okay. Well, let me go to Simon Nicholson again at the Forum for Climate Engineering Assessment. Let me ask you about this question of unintentionally causing floods or droughts or other kinds of disruptions that would have an impact on people, an unpredictable impact perhaps, by this kind of geoengineering. Are you concerned about that?
Yeah, that claim, Warren, is based on a set of modeling studies that were done a few years ago. And what those modeling studies did is they had the understanding that this type of climate engineering that we're talking about might be quite rapid and would be across a very steep curve. And what I mean by that is they tried to really turn down temperatures very rapidly. And when they did that in the models, then you started to see some weather implications that were troubling. Some folks pointed to, for instance, the potential to shut off monsoon rains in South Asia. But the sort of solar geoengineering that David is talking about, in part informed by those studies, is a little different. It's not to try and take us back to some prior Earth, but rather to try and reduce climate risks over, in the way that he talks about it, a shorter term.
Let me go back to Jack Stilgo again at the University College in London. What do you say to the question of who would be helped and who wouldn't? Would this, in fact, be good for the poorest and most vulnerable, India, for example? Since it's easy to do, as we heard from David Keith, would they be likely, do you think, to get on board? Could we have some kind of unanimity or something close to it worldwide?
Well, I think the first point is to say that when we start those sort of cost-benefit analyses, right, are we thinking about the impact on weather and how those might influence people's ability to grow crops and things that would be materially important to them? I mean, that might be one consideration. But also, let's think about how people in the global south have or haven't benefited from grand technological schemes in the past. And there, the history of technology provides a pretty patchy story. I mean, there are examples of major technological successes that have alleviated poverty, like vaccines. But there are also examples where there are more examples where technologies have widened the gap between rich and poor just because powerful people are able to take advantage of those technologies. And to the point that this would be relatively cheap and easy, I think that's something that we need to question. I mean, it's an idea that has been allowed to determine the debate up to now, is that, in effect, this, you know, solar geoengineering would be orders of magnitude cheaper than dealing with climate change in the sort of messy, expensive way that we've been doing up till now. And I think the honest answer is that we have absolutely no idea how cheap it would be, right? These ideas haven't left the drawing board. And if we start the research that to try to work out the full social and technological complexity of the thing, we might find out that actually this is a whole lot more difficult, just as nuclear power turned out to be a whole lot more difficult to deliver once you add in all of the complexities. And once we realize those difficulties, maybe we'll stop speculating about it and we'll turn our attention to other things.
Now that there is public discussion of this, which there hasn't been before, it's my understanding that there already is a sort of conspiracy theory community, if you will, growing up about it, and people who mistakenly believe that the government is doing this and it's going to do it to us, and the sort of arguments that we often hear in other context. Jack Stilgo, is that in fact already happening, and is it going to be necessary to cope with it?
Well, there is a conspiracy theory out there that has got wrapped up in the geoengineering debate. I, as a social scientist, see that as a huge shame, because I, like David Keith, would want a forceful and widespread democratic discussion about the goods and bads of geoengineering. And if people are mixing up geoengineering with ideas about chemtrails and such, then I think that overshadows that discussion. So I think it's a gigantic and unhelpful distraction.
Simon Nicholson, is it possible that there could be international destabilization, as we've heard suggested?
That's one thing that people have been concerned about, certainly. And so one story that's often told in this space is about attribution. A few years ago, there was a gigantic flood in the Indus River in Pakistan. And one could imagine that if a few years prior, India had announced a research program and potential deployment of sulfate particles into the atmosphere, whether or not it was that solar geoengineering that caused the flooding, you can imagine that folks in Pakistan would point the finger. And so there are real political implications of making a move in this direction, because up until now, climate change has been seen as a common problem. We're all contributing to it. We're all somehow culpable. But when we get to solar geoengineering, where we can point to a handful of actors who are actually taking steps to try and intervene in planetary processes, then we get to some very, very thorny political issues.
Raymond Humbert at Oxford, you've said it's a bad idea even to do research and experimentation. Is there any way, however, to stop it?
So I should give some nuance to that. So there's some kinds of experimentation you just can't forbid without having a chilling effect on atmospheric research in general, the sort that we need, because there's a huge amount of overlap between fundamental atmospheric processes we need to understand better and the sort of things we need to understand in order if anybody did want to do albedo modification, solar geoengineering. So the sort of experimentation that we were in favor of in the National Academy report was making good use of natural experiments, studying what happens after a volcanic eruption, which actually tests some of the global effects. Similarly, computer modeling, it would just have a chilling effect to forbid computer modeling. How much money a government should put into stimulating that is another question. But I think David's proposed experiment, although it's small and harmless from a physical standpoint, does cross a thin red line into doing it in an in-your-face way, saying we are going to do this in the atmosphere, and there's no governance right now other than what Harvard imposes on itself. And they are doing an honest job in trying to impose some self-governance on this, but where do you draw the line? Who says what is an intolerably big experiment?
Okay, David, and Keith, what's your response to that? We're just about out of time. Go ahead.
Well, it's simply not the true that there's no governance. I think there's inadequate governance for experiments, and that's why we're trying to encourage the growth of that, but there absolutely is governance.
Beyond Harvard?
NEPA, the National Environmental Protection Act, is one of the instruments of governance, and that has the power in the end to put me in handcuffs. It's real. So we'll be working through the FAA and through NEPA to get a formal ruling through NEPA, and that absolutely, that's hard law. It's not just what we say at Harvard.
Okay. We're going to have to leave it at that, but thank you all very much for helping us better understand a subject I don't think many people have heard about before, which, however, we probably will be hearing a lot about as the days go by. David Keith at Harvard, again, where he is a solar geoengineering researcher. Raymond Pierre Humbert, professor of physics, University of Oxford. Simon Nicholson at the Forum for Climate Engineering Assessment, and Jack Stilgo at the University College London and author of Experiment Earth, Responsible Innovation in Geoengineering. Many thanks to you all. In a moment, the Trump administration is renewing the war on drugs. This is To the Point from PRI. Well, we're only back with today's talking point. Barack Obama's Attorney General Eric Holder ordered federal prosecutors not to bring charges against minor drug offenders that could lead to lifelong penalties. He said they should consider individual circumstances for drug crimes. Today, Attorney General Jeff Sessions said those days are over.
Going forward, I have empowered our prosecutors to charge and pursue the most serious offense, as I believe the law requires, most serious, readily provable offense.
Matt Zabikowski reports for The Washington Post. Good to have you on our program.
Hey, thank you for having me.
How would you explain this as a Justice Department reporter for The Washington Post's national security team? I should give you your full title.
I would say that this is it's a return to the war on drugs. Look, when Eric Holder was in office, he issued guidance to U.S. attorneys across the country that they should charge cases in such a way that they didn't trigger mandatory minimum sentences. Sessions comes in only a couple months on the job and says, we're doing away with that. And he tells them, go the other way. Charge cases as aggressively as you can, charge the most serious offense you can prove, and then let the law kick in. If that triggers a mandatory minimum, that is what we want. We're trying to put drug dealers behind bars. So this is just like an outright reversal of the Obama administration policies and a return to sort of days of old.
So what about mass incarceration, and what would be the impact on that?
Well, I imagine the prison population will increase, and I would say that Jeff Sessions kind of forecast that. Earlier this year, he revoked another Obama-era directive for the Justice Department to get out of the business of using private prisons to sort of not renew contracts with private prisons as they came up and move that inmate population just into the broader Bureau of Prisons. Sessions undid that. One of the reasons the Obama administration was able to do that is because the inmate population had been dwindling. Sessions sort of said, we don't think that's still going to happen. The Bureau of Prisons needs the flexibility to handle a big inmate population. That kind of forecasts this. I mean, he definitely expects that this will put more people behind bars and grow the federal prison population.
So this then is a real skin back, as you pointed out, from the idea that it's very expensive to incarcerate people. There are better ways of treating them, particularly if they are a relatively minor league drug offenders, and consequently we should treat that as a medical problem rather than as a crime. Sessions isn't buying that at all.
He's not. Now, he would say on this that, look, we're not talking about minor drug offenders. He would say we're going after the dealers. The quantities of drugs that trigger these mandatory minimums are very high. For heroin, for example, it's a kilogram, which is about 10,000 doses of heroin. So his take on this is, look, we're not getting somebody who's smoking a joint on the street and throwing them in jail for 10 years. We're getting drug dealers and throwing them in jail for a long time. But look, he's not apologetic about that. He thinks that's the right thing to do.
But from a prosecutorial standpoint, it's a lot easier to go after the joint smoker, isn't it? And isn't he suggesting that that they do that? Are they liable to try to sort of run up their statistics?
Well, the feds are not as likely to go after just someone, you know, smoking a joint on the street, let's say. That's much more likely to be a state-level offense. The feds typically have gone after players in drug organizations, but there's a whole range of those, you know, who Sessions sees as sort of a bad drug dealer could be a pretty poor, low-level guy who just gets caught with a quantity, you know, a big quantity of drugs. And Jeff Sessions would have that person go to jail for a long time based on that quantity. Again, he would say that person is bad, that person is contributing to a problem. But I think you're right that the other side of the aisle would say, I don't know that that's right, and that is going to be costly to incarcerate all the people like that.
Well, we'd hear about the drug courier who didn't really know what he was doing or had to do it because he was desperate, or all the kinds of arguments that are made to mitigate situations like this, which I gather Mr. Sessions doesn't want to know about. What about the legalization of marijuana in various states, which is going on so very quickly? And I mean recreational marijuana, not just medical marijuana. Did the Attorney General say anything about that today?
Well, he didn't address that today, but I can tell you that this memo does not revoke another memo in the Obama administration known as the Cole memo that sort of laid out how the Justice Department should treat states that legalize marijuana. So the policy now, which Sessions did not revoke, is we can charge people federally even in these states where it's legal, but we recognize that we have limited resources. So in states where it's legal, let's basically look and see how their regulatory system is. If it's pretty robust, then we'll lay off. Sessions has not yet undone that with this new guidance.
On the other hand, he can look at the regulatory systems, which are fairly well along in a couple of states. But here in California, for example, where a recreational use has just been established, the system hasn't been set up as yet. This is not a state that's popular with the Trump administration.
Yeah, he certainly could. And look, it's still possible that he will revoke that Cole guidance. He's sort of hinted at that, and his stance on marijuana is no secret. I mean, he has said he even thinks that medical marijuana is overhyped. It's just a drug that is definitely in his crosshairs. So he has not revoked the guidance yet on marijuana, but it's certainly possible that he will.
If the prison population is going to increase, is that going to mean new business after all for those who run private prisons?
Oh, I think
certainly. You know, Sessions really gave them a boom when he came in and as one of his first acts said, you know, the Justice Department is going to keep using them because they were looking at, I mean, this is the industry, but 12 big facilities holding, you know, tens of thousands of inmates closing over the next several years. That was the goal in the Obama administration. And now you can envision, and this is a long-term thing, right? It takes a long time for people to get charged, convicted, and sentenced and then go to prison. But in the long term, you know, if these policies stick, you would certainly see, you know, see them get more business.
Do public subsidies go, particularly federal subsidies, go to the private prison people?
Well, how they work is that the government signs contracts with these companies that run the private prisons. So they give them, you know, a certain amount of money per bed or per inmate. It just depends on the contract. So, you know, that's how they make money in these situations.
What about crime? Is it going up?
You know, it is. Last year, the first half of last year, violent crime, I think, went up about 5%. Murders are up in a lot of big cities around the country. But crime is still at historic lows. Sessions just has a very bleak worldview that, you know, we've seen some increases in some big cities. The latest FBI data, for the first half of 2016, do show an increase in violent crime. He's worried that that is like portending this new period of violence. Crime, though, is still at historic lows, you know, but it's important to know that about his worldview because that's what's informing all these, you know, tough on crime, as he would term them, policies.
And we're talking about orders that go out to the U.S. attorneys. How many U.S. attorneys are there around the country?
Well, there are 94 districts, you know, with a presidentially appointed U.S. attorneys, and they control all the what are called the assistant U.S. attorneys across the country, and there are, gosh, thousands of them, I think more than 5,000 all across the country, and you know, they do federal drug cases. There are many more prosecutors at the state level who this memo does not affect. We're talking about the U.S. attorney's offices and the people underneath them.
All right. Matt Zapatowski, the Justice Department correspondent for The Washington Post's National Security Team. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you.
To the Point, produced this week by Katie Cooper, Andrea Brody, Sasha Woodruff, Yael Evan-Orr, and Luke Vanderplug. Our technical director is Mike Newport, our managing producer, Evan George. Thanks to the John Coltrane family. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.